Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
How's it going?
It's going all right. It's toasty warm here today.
Really?
Unusually for February. It's a record high today. It's in the high 60s.
Oh, fancy.
Yeah, I sat on the porch for a while. It was nice.
Wow.
I figure as long as the earth is heating up, I might as well enjoy it.
Take advantage of it. Yeah. Indeed. You should do that. Yeah, it's not raining today, so I'll count that as a win. Not raining.
It's a good start.
Yeah, it's not bad. It's not bad. It's like 57 outside. It's sunny. Nice. The dog got tired on the walk. She was panting a little bit. So I guess it's not too cold.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
We should I was thinking of what to talk about in this podcast, and I realized I can talk about the thing that I did because Lex Fridman asked me to. But I think
it's always dangerous.
It is really. But I think listeners to the secret podcast will not be as surprised about it as the readers might have been, only because we have talked a lot about our adventures in home automation, including many of the complaints I make in that article. And so, you know, we don't really need to get into it. But in the follow up, some people thought that you wrote it because you did your red alert thing. Even though I refer to that and say that was Dan and this is me, but people don't care. Anyway, Lex wanted to know how you would set up. So if you have your lights going on and they're smart lights, they like go on at night and stay on until the morning. What would you do to make them be a special color if it's a holiday? That was the premise of it.
Sure. Yeah.
And my initial response was really like, no problem. And then I thought about it. And I was like, wow, actually, that's really hard. And that led me into what we have talked about here for sure in the past, which is that all those tools for this sort of thing, the tie-in web services and look stuff up and all of that, are way too simple to do something even as basic as this, which is just like, I think I broke it down into like four steps that would solve it. Like, you know, check my calendar. If it's a holiday, do this. If it isn't, just make the lights the regular color and turn them on. Right. And you can't do that now. I did hear from some people who said, like, well, you could do that with, like, Peter Lewis wrote in to say, you could do that with Keyboard Maestro. And it's like, okay, but then you have to have a Mac running all the time to automate your lights? Like,
right.
I do have a Mac running on all the time, but like, no, I will not accept that as an answer. This is something that the cloud should do, right? My smart light bulbs should be able to be commanded by the internet to do the right thing.
And, I command you.
Yeah, and right now you can do it. It's just ridiculous. And when I read Federico Fatici at Mac Stories talk about like all the different things that you can do with workflow and other kind of script things on iPads and things like that, I think what we need is a simple workflow like process for logic for web services. And you know, Zapier, which I used for this project, totally is that. I mean, I wouldn't say it's easy, but it's easy-ish. I could figure it out. You don't have to be a coder to do it. The problem is Zapier is not connected to smart devices, so you have to like bridge from there to if this then that just to fire off a command to your light bulbs, which is dumb. So, you know, again, this is nothing that we haven't already said before, but it's frustrating. Like, okay, everything is here now and you can't do anything like clever with it, only like super basic stuff.
Right. The tools need to come up a notch in order to deal with the sort of proliferation of all of these easily accessible hardware items.
Well, and people, I think one of the challenges is that people think in terms of apps instead of web services, and that's fine. I would be okay with an app that let me do this if the output ran on a web service, because what I don't want is I can do it on my phone, but then my phone has to be around. Like,
right. Well, this is kind of Apple's, you know, tried to sort of do this by with the having both the Apple TV and potentially, I guess, if you want to set up an iPad, you can also use it for this, but having them serve as like a hub. And that is fine. Although, as I've said before, I've noticed some inconsistencies with the Apple TV as a home hub. Specifically, I have one rule on it, and that is turn off the light in my office at 12:30. And sometimes it just doesn't do it for no reason that I can ever figure out. Yeah. And that's really weird. And like, also seems like not even lower than table stakes. Like, that's just like, this is a really basic function. But you know, and that's fine because the Apple TV is there and always on.
Right.
But and the for some devices like the Philips Hue, I believe the Hue Bridge does store potential, can store rules on it that are basically input from the app.
Yeah, I think that's true because there's a physical box that's the Hue Bridge that's sitting there running all the time in your house.
Yeah, yeah. But like the fact that you have to have that box in addition to an Apple TV if like Home Hub stuff is kind of silly. Like, how many of these things do you need different bridges for, right? Like, am I going to end up with 8 different bridges?
I know, right? I mean, I guess that's the argument for HomeKit is that if you, one of them is that it, like some other standards, if you just get everything that's HomeKit, then your Apple TV or your iPad or whatever can be your bridge and you don't have to worry about it, except it doesn't necessarily work. But I kind of wanted to, and even then, like the HomeKit, its automation is also really basic.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're back to that again, which is how do I say, I want my lights to be red on Valentine's Day and green on St. Patrick's Day. And the answer is you kind of can't unless you use some sort of system that will query like a calendar and like a holidays calendar or one that you set up. And it's like, it's kind of ridiculous. And, or you wait for somebody to build a like custom holiday
light thing,
which is just, it's just dumb. Whereas if you change a couple of these things together, you can make it work. I don't know. I guess they'll get there. They're trying. There's stuff out there. And I hear Mike Hurley talks about using Zapier a lot, and he picked it up from Federico and Fraser Spears. But the nice thing about stuff like Zapier is it's kind of like web service automation. So, you know, if you've got an iOS device and you can't do a lot of automation, like incredibly powerful automation on it, like you can on a Mac that's got command line access and things like that. Between Workflow and Zapier, you can kind of do a lot because Workflow will control things on your device and some things over the internet, and Zapier will kind of do anything you can think of over the internet. And that's cool. It's just not, you know, it's all still kind of boiling down. It's not simplified and
it's funny because it's the it's kind of the worst of both worlds, right? Because it's neither powerful enough to satisfy people like us who enjoy tinkering with that kind of thing, nor is it easy to use enough that most mainstream people will find
exactly.
and or use it.
Exactly.
And that's the opposite of the sweet spot. It's the sour spot.
No, the right thing to do, and the thing that HomeKit does do and that Hue does, is like basic scheduling on device, right? Like the right thing is that you shouldn't have to set up an if this then that set of routines in order to say, I want you to turn the light on at this time and off at this time. Like that, you should be able to do that, and you can do that in those apps. Although even then, I don't think they can do. One of the things I really like is that I have my lights turn on very early and then turn off at sunrise and then turn on at sunset and turn off at a given time. And, you know, and my iPhone knows where I live, right?
Right, exactly. Well, and as I've mentioned before, I get the annoying thing where it's like, I want the light in my office to turn on at before sunset, because by the time sunset has rolled around, it is too dark.
Oh, interesting.
Like, because of where I am and where the sun comes into my windows, if I have it turn on at sunset, then my office has already, like, I will have given up and turned the light on already by that point.
I see. Yeah, because I'm using it to turn lights on outside.
Right, I'm using the inside light. Yeah. So, for example, yeah. And so what I want is for it to turn on an hour before the sun goes down.
Right. Extra and complication.
That is not possible with HomeKit. It is possible. It was possible with the old Wemo switch I used. And in fact, I found a third-party iOS app that interfaces with the Hue Bridge and lets you set that.
Huh.
Again, that is ridiculous that I need to go find another app just for the purpose of doing that. So, kind of a mess, as we're saying.
Yeah. I've been thinking about podcast apps this week.
I noticed. I've seen quite a bit about podcast apps. Well, it's been a big week for podcast apps.
Big week. Overcast 3, Castro 2.3, both came out. And then I wrote a thing about today about podcast triage, because the way Overcast 3 works, I have sort of changed my approach to listening to podcasts, where I basically got a queue podcast that is like what I'm going to be listening to it's not my podcast playlist that's entirely John Delancey. That's a different Q. Totally different Q playlist.
It's all Desmond Llewellyn.
Yeah. Well, it's Desmond Llewellyn and John Delancey all in together. Just Q on Q.
Yeah,
Q versus Q.
That would be a great show if Desmond Llewellyn was still alive. I would listen to that podcast.
Yeah. So what I have is I've got the one playlist that's what I'm listening to, and there's a few podcasts that kind of trickle into it that are just like, yes, every episode, just put it in there. And then I have an all episodes playlist, and what I do with Overcast 3 is I just sort of like look through that list and tap on ones and go, yeah, add that to the playlist. And it's just kind of a triage area. It's very similar to how Castro works, and people who have not tried Castro and feel the need to really do a lot of picking and choosing about what they listen to, like on a per episode basis, Castro is designed for that. That's like, and I talked to people who use it. Like I was talking to Glenn Fleischman the other day, and he loves Castro because it fits perfectly with how he wants to handle his podcast listening, which is very carefully choosing from a list of like new episodes, which ones he wants to bother downloading and listening to. And that's right. Cool. That's cool. So, but that has changed. Using Overcast 3 in a similar way has definitely changed my podcast system. I think for the better, because I'm getting exactly what I absolutely want, and then it's fairly easy to find an episode that I want to throw on the pile and just throw it in and have it play next, or have it just kind of be added to the list.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting because I was actually on a panel this past weekend talking about podcasts, and one of the components of that was recommending podcasts. And as I often find myself in a scenario like that, what I realized was I don't listen to a lot of podcasts. And so it's my podcast app usage is incredibly different, because it's often I want to listen to this one thing right now. And it turns out that a lot of podcast apps are not necessarily designed for that, which is interesting, because sometimes if it's a show that I listen to occasionally and I'm like, oh, there's a new episode of this thing out and I feel interested in listening to it, that's not too bad, because I can go, if I've like added it to my subscription list in Overcast or the Apple podcast app or Castor or whatever, like I can kind of easily find it. But the idea that like, oh yeah, I just want to hear this episode of this one show, I have to go into an app. I have to usually like subscribe to that podcast. Then I have to find the episode I want to listen to. Yeah. Then I have to download the episode. So I realize I am totally weird like that. And if I listen to as many podcasts as most people, I'm sure that this, like, if I listen to them regularly, that would probably be fine. But I feel like nobody's built the podcast app that's the podcast app for me.
Yeah, it's hard. I think Castro fits a lot of uses because it does the whole, like, you tell us what you're interested in, we'll provide you a list, and you can choose what you want to listen to. And, like, it doesn't download it until it gets to that point. And I prefer, you know, having most of it downloaded already. I like the way that Overcast handles Now Playing and all of that. It's closer to it. But, you know, neither of us listens to a lot of this stuff just because we work at home and don't have commutes. And so I listen when I walk the dog and when I do the dishes or cook and when I take showers. And that's about it. And if I have to drive somewhere, which I do occasionally, but not often. I drive in San Francisco the other day, and I got in, you know, a couple hours of podcast listening, or an hour and a half of podcast listening. That was kind of great. It's a motivator to go outside, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
What else is going on?
You know, I wrote a thing which won't show up until tomorrow over at Macworld, but it's never too early to start talking about the next iPhone rumors. And the things that interested me this time around, because a lot of times we discount, you know, rumors. Sometimes these things get picked out and end up having substance to them. A lot of times they don't. I feel like in particular this year, there are rumors this year that I feel like I see every year. Like the edge-to-edge screen rumor. I feel like that one is going on like 3 or 4 years now. Or the getting rid of the home button, which, while plausible, again, I feel like I've seen for many years now. But what interested me this time around was that I found there are multiple rumors about different, basically different forms of biometrics that Apple might integrate into the next iPhone. Specifically, discussing iris recognition and facial recognition. And I did some looking around at these things, and I was kind of interested to see how they play out. And I'm overall, it's sort of curious because there is sort of a smoke fire thing where it's like, well, there's multiple different suggestions about this. Obviously, you know, they are Apple already uses Touch ID for biometric authentication. But what struck me as kind of interesting, if I took a step back about this, was thinking to myself, well, there are a lot of cases in which Touch ID either doesn't work very well because of situational uses. So if you've ever gotten, you had like wet hands or used the iPhone when it is in the rain or some form where it's gotten water on it, Touch ID does not work well. You have to wipe off the sensor, wipe off your finger, etc.
Yep.
That can occasionally be annoying. So the question is, are there other things solve this problem? And the other challenge is, there are people for whom, you know, for accessibility or disability reasons, cannot use that feature, right? Like, you know, there are people who don't have the access to, you know, fingers on that hand or what have you, or simply can't, are not mobile in a way that lets them use that easily. And so, I wondered if there might be a utility to having a different form of biometric authentication that would let those people have, you know, better security without, like, having to sacrifice convenience. And of the two, so facial recognition is pretty standard. You can actually get that in a number of different places. There are a bunch of technologies that use cameras to essentially look at your face and see if you appear to be a person. Those technologies are also not always the best for biometric authentication because they're kind of easy to trick. I did a story back when I was still writing at Popular Science a couple of years ago in which I think my banking app added like face authentication. And well, I made a creepy, what I described as a creepy serial killer mask, where I made like, I printed out a picture of myself and then cut the eyes out because it required you to do blinking. And I was like, that didn't work. But what I discovered was much easier and worked was if you have a video of yourself, it actually is pretty easy to do. So wow. Those things can often be tricked by videos or images. That's just the way it works, right? Because it's like, it can, using a camera, it's more or less just taking a two-dimensional
image. Hey, there's Dan.
Yeah, there is. And the danger there is obviously everybody's carrying around high quality video cameras these days, and there are cameras in the wild in a lot of places. So getting video footage of you is not that hard. Now, the rumored technology for that is something involving laser scanning and 3D facial recognition, which is essentially kind of close to what Hollywood does when it sort of does mapping for actors to do like mocap stuff. They sort of like, you know, in these cases, they shoot like lasers at your face or a pattern of light at your face and then essentially measure the distance from each of those things to sort of create a geometrical structure. Somebody who knows a lot more about this is probably going to tell me why I'm totally wrong about how exactly that works. But there are a number of different technologies that can be used for this. In theory, that would let you do some stuff better. And it deals with things like lighting and stuff like that without being a huge problem. But I haven't seen any consumer level applications of that technology to date, so I'm not convinced that that is anywhere near the mainstream availability. What is interesting is that the iris recognition thing, which is distinct from retinal scanning, is actually fairly easy to do by comparison, in that it essentially can do it with an infrared LED. Which I guess is pretty similar to what you have on like your remote controls. And it's actually there. Microsoft actually put out two of its Lumia smartphones that had this built in. So this is a technology that clearly is at the commercial consumer level and is plausible. And I think would probably be both sort of low power, since LEDs don't generally require a lot of power, and fairly easy and pretty pretty secure as far as like, you know, it works the same way Touch ID was, which is it like takes an image of the thing in question, in this case your iris, and then builds a mathematical model around that and can then compare that later on. So that's certainly plausible. Whether that's something Apple's going to do or not, I don't know. But, it sort of opened up this idea to me of like, what if there was like an authentication kit framework which could use any of a variety of different manners to authenticate a person, and you could just choose which one to use. That seems like a very Apple thing to do. It could store all this information on the secure element. You know, essentially having paved that way with Touch ID, there's no reason they couldn't expand it to other forms of biometric authentication if they wanted to. And it might possibly open up, you know, security things on other devices that don't have, like, there's no Touch ID sensor for anything but the MacBook Pro right now on the Mac side.
Right.
But you've got cameras, you've got other things, you know, technology that could be used for some of this stuff. So I'm kind of interested to see if Apple is going to expand their approach to biometric security. I think they're probably at least looking at a bunch of this stuff. There was this report that they had bought a company that does facial recognition. Now, there are obviously a bunch of other different things they could do with that, including stuff related to, say, photos. But it is certainly one piece of the technology they might need. So I'm kind of curious to see if there is any substance to any of this. It might not materialize now, but it could be something they're working on.
One of the things that comes up when people talk about this is the fact that we've had some biometric stuff on some various Android phones in the past. And of course, famously, they could be tricked. I think your paper mask thing can actually trick.
Some things. Yeah, you probably need to work a little hard. You need to do a better job of it than I did. Let's put it that way.
But I think, so you can apply skepticism to this and say, well, you know, haven't we already learned that those have lots of issues? I would say that I have great faith in Apple on this point, but I would also say that Apple is well aware of its position in the market. And I think Apple is really confident in its security approach internally, that they know that any security feature they provide has to be rock solid. Like, they are not going to be able to get away with a, you know, BS security feature that's more for laughs or for show than for security, which I would argue a bunch of those Android features were exactly that. They were like, oh, isn't this cool? Oh, it totally doesn't work. Whereas Touch ID, although people have
you can
beat it, but it
requires work. Yeah,
it's really hard. And, you know, at that point, you're at the level of, if I lift your fingerprints and I can, you know, right? I mean,
if you're worried about the government breaking into your phone, like that's one thing, you know, if somebody that has a lot of resources or somebody that has targeted you specifically.
Yes, James Bond can get into your phone using Touch ID because he will lift your prints off of the martini glass and generate in his breast pocket, he's got a latex finger from fingerprint 3D printer, and he will get into your phone. But, you know, a regular,
if someone robs your house, then they're not going to spend the time lifting your fingerprints.
Right. And the goal with a lot of this biometric security stuff is not to increase the security from a passcode as much as it is to make it easier to unlock the phone. Like, in fact, I would argue that one of the reasons the biometric security stuff is so great is because it allows you to put a more sophisticated password on your device because you don't have to enter it very often. And that increases security because the 4-digit code is kind of dumb, but my phone is password protected with a letters and symbols and numbers kind of a password. And I would not do that if I had to do that every time I unlock my phone.
Yeah. Right? I mean, as a matter of fact, a few weeks ago, I was visiting my girlfriend, and there was some update, iOS update or something, that briefly screwed with the Touch ID sensor on her phone. For whatever reason, it was not recognizing her fingerprints even after multiple retrainings. And so she was stuck in a situation where she had to enter her very long passcode every time. And I've never seen her quite so angry at a piece of technology, because even though she knew logically that that was the right, you know, secure thing to do, it was so inconvenient. And so I think, again, I totally agree with you. I jacked up my passcode when I added Touch ID. It's there as a convenient shortcut. It's not a substitute for good security. You can't just be like, oh, it's my fingerprint, I don't ever have to worry about this again, right? They didn't implement that as, like, you can do this or a passcode, in the sense you can have one or the other, right? You still need a passcode to enable Touch ID.
Yeah, exactly right. So I think if Apple's going to do this, they're going to do it right. because they know that everybody will be scrutinizing them. And the idea is that it's not creating a heightened security. It's just it's going to extend what they've already done with Touch ID, which is make it convenient in certain circumstances for you, if you want to unlock your phone with your, you know, with your body, with your person in some way that, you know, for day to day. And if that's like giving your phone the eye until the evil eye until it unlocks, unlock you, I'm looking at you, but pop, it opens up. Or whether it's, some other kind of facial gesture or blinking, or whether it's just putting your thumb somewhere like the back or the front or wherever they put the Touch ID sensor if it's a new phone. That's all good, but you know, also we should say, legally, I believe you can be compelled to yes. unlock your devices physically, but not to disclose your passwords. So if you're traveling Correct. Someplace like across a border where you think that they might compel you to unlock your device, one thing you can and probably should do is for those periods of time you should turn it off, because then you can refuse the refuse to enter a password, but you can't refuse to put your thumbprint on the Touch ID sensor.
Yeah, I kind of wish that Apple actually would build in a way to quickly and easily like force that, essentially, like disable the Touch ID and require you to enter a password, which happens, right? If you fail to enter, if your fingerprint doesn't work several times in a row.
Yeah.
I mean, that was kind of the shortcut I thought of, was hit an unregistered fingerprint on it like 5 or 6 times.
What I've heard is see if you can basically suck on the finger or use a non-trained finger and get it to error out a few times.
Yeah, exactly.
Once it errors out because your finger's wet or it's the wrong finger, it'll lock.
Or force reboot it if you have time to do that.
I suppose that's true.
It will require you to enter the passcode.
Yeah, exactly.
So those are pro tips for dealing with, you know, for reasons. Yeah. This might come up. You never know. The iris thing in particular, I think, is interesting because it does deal with, as I said, you know, things like wet fingers and other things where it's like, this doesn't work well in these cases. And particularly for people who live, say, in my neck of the woods, where several months out of the year, except for today, it's cold and you're wearing gloves and it's kind of annoying. They've gotten to the point where they have, you know, gloves that work with touchscreens, and that's fine, but you can't use Touch ID with a glove
right.
on. And so
glove
having
ID coming soon.
Yeah. Having something like that where you could still easily open your phone without having to, you know, fiddle with your gloves or whatever, I think would be a it would make sense to
have
me.
You tried to play a fiddle with gloves on? It's really hard,
especially a touchscreen fiddle, let me tell you. GarageBand,
what
fiddle. Yeah, don't try it at home.
A fiddle with a touchscreen, it's worse than a toaster fridge.
delicious toaster fridge.
All right,
I think anything else?
No.
It's slow week.
I think week. I was talking to somebody earlier who was saying to me, this is, let 2017 be the year of people speculating and arguing about whether iPads are the future of computing. I thought, my response was, and this is somebody who's not a tech podcaster or writer or anything, and I said, there's not a lot going on right now in the tech world. Like, I used to be able to look at Nuzzle and see like what all the links that my Twitter feed was sharing, and it was all about tech, and now I'm hard-pressed to find a tech story on that list because everybody is tweeting about the government and politics and things like that right now. And
same thing on Twitter.
Yeah, and the tech stuff is harder, and this is normally a quiet time for tech stuff too. So you know, we'll talk about iPads and things up until Apple does an event. I hope in a few weeks, right? I mean, people are talking about how
rumor is March. Yeah.
The rumor is March, and you know, March is a whole month long, people. So it could be anywhere in there. I hope we find out soon about when exactly it is, at least get a rumor of it. I'm supposed to go to Yosemite in mid-March, and if they, last year they did the event, I think they did it the week before, but I was going to have to cancel that, and this year the same thing applies, which is the Yosemite conference is this great conference in the park, but you know, if Apple does an event that week, then I'm going to have to bail because, you know. Gotta go to Apple. And then the other question is, where would that event be? Presumably,
right.
They do it at Yerba Buena, or they would do it at, you know, California Theater in San Jose or something. I don't think the new Steve Jobs Auditorium is
available. I was going to say, it's probably getting close, though.
Well, they could. I mean, they're not going to move people into the Apple Park campus until April, right?
Right.
So,
yep.
So unless they've finished the auditorium first, but I've heard several people say, don't you think that'll be where the iPhone event is?
Yeah.
And I think that sounds right.
I think that sounds right.
So they'll have to do this somewhere else.
It's a lot bigger than Yerba Buena, right?
Yeah.
It's supposed to be like 1,000 seats or something.
Yeah. Yeah. But Yerba Buena would work for an iPad event, I think.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. They could do that.
So maybe that's what it is. I don't know, but let's hope they do that because, you know, speculation is fun to do, but reality is better. Like talk about the real stuff and getting your hands on it and trying to figure out what's good and bad about it and all of that is going to be more fun than the philosophizing about it. As much as philosophizing is necessary, especially like you and I, you need to write 800 to 1,000 words every week for Macworld. Well, I did more of that today. My piece is about, you know, it's more like future of iPad productivity to week 2 of 2, because, you know, that's what we're left with sometimes when there's not a lot going on. So I hope we get more new stuff. I'm looking forward to it. I'd like new Mac stuff too. I'd like to see like what they're doing with the iMac and where the MacBook is going, and yeah, maybe. But yeah. I guess that's speculation for another podcast.
Indeed.
All right. Thanks to everybody out there for listening to The Secret Podcast. Thanks for subscribing to Six Colors. We really appreciate it. And we'll be back. But until then, bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.